This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on? What is going on?
Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 21, submission 102, the $1.98 Beauty Show. It was syndicated and it aired from September of 1978 to September of 1980 for 78 episodes.
From Hollywood, the glamour capital of the world, join us in a make-believe search for the most beautiful girl on earth. It's a $1.98 Beauty Show, an entertainment spectacular if ever there was one, where beauty is not only in the eyes of the beholder, but also on this very stage. Tonight, the $1.98 Beauty Show will continue its relentless spoof of all of those other so-called beauty contests. And although this is not a real contest, we will bring you our version of the All-American Beauty, that one-of-a-kind girl who not only has personality and poise, but beauty and talent as well. Yes, sir, the $1.98 Beauty Show will be bringing you tons of talented and beautiful women every single week. Happy women, terrified women, women singing and dancing and parading about in the latest bathing suits. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of San Tropez. And now, here's the host and star of the show, Mr. Beauty himself, Rip Taylor.
Exciting and beautiful women you've ever seen on this stage, waiting to find out which one will be this week's $1.98 beauty. One of which is the beautiful Tahitian dancer who once said, "I want everyone to see my beautiful body." We'll meet her and her competition right after this message.
And guys, the 70s were a wild time.
Oh, yeah.
Man, it was such a time in America. People were disco dancing. People were doing coke. And people were watching weird television like this, the $1.98 Beauty Show. And boy, guys, this was something else.
Yeah, we were talking a couple weeks ago about jiggle television. This was either a parody of it or a celebration of it, depending on your personal purview. But they were here for it for two whole seasons.
Greg, you said at the beginning the 70s were a time for discoing, for doing coke, and for weird television shows?
Yep.
I think you just, like, did the textbook definition of Chuck Barris right there.
Whoa. Chuck Barris kept it clean. Yes, he was twisted, but he kept it clean.
Hey, I didn't get into the other stuff Chuck Barris was allegedly doing in the 70s.
Oh, there's movies about that and books about that. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is definitely a must-see if you want to learn more about the subject. But yeah, Chuck Barris, he was, dare I call him an anti-producer?
He was sort of king of the anti-producers, anti-hosts. Yes, he kept on the up and up behind the scenes, but when his face was on the camera and his name was in the credits, you are almost assured of, A, at the very least, a good time, and B, well, that was pretty much it, because one of Chuck Barris's hallmarks is, to quote Julie Chen, expect the unexpected.
I would take it a step further and add the word lunacy. If you look at the shows he did, produced Newlywed Game and Dating Game. He didn't create the Newlywed Game, though. That was Nicholson and Muir who did pay cards and super pay cards. How they went from Newlywed Game to super pay cards, who the hell knows? But also, he did Treasure Hunt, and he did Gong Show, which is by far his most popular show. He also did Three's a Crowd, which, spoiler, is a future entry. But also he did, spoiler, future entry, Camouflage. I'm sorry, those two shows are absolutely horrible. I mean, he sort of hit his apex around 77, 78, and then he just went right down the mountain. He went to Three's a Crowd and Camouflage. The new Treasure Hunt was decent, or the Treasure Hunt,
the
syndicated version in 81.
Treasure Hunt was awesome.
Treasure Hunt was great. But
81 Treasure Hunt, we got to put 81 Treasure Hunt is the best.
Yes, I didn't think we were going to cover it at Treasure Hunt, but that's a possibility.
We should. We should.
Well, there were like three versions of Treasure Hunt to cover, so.
That'll take an hour. Put it on the list.
There you go. Show prep in the middle of an episode. Awesome. So we go to 1976, where ABC had already canceled the Dating Game and the Newlywed Game, but they had encouraged him to revive the Dating Game and the Newlywed Game for syndication, as well as adding another show, because, again, he also had the Gong Show going on NBC, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And he came up with sort of a pastiche on the beauty show, the beauty contest, which was basically, let's do Miss America if it were 30 minutes long and we didn't have the budget for anything extravagant.
We had a budget of $2. $2.
That's all we can give away, folks. $1.98. We got to give this away.
It's like, okay, and we need somebody who is like Burt Parks, but willing to work for scale. Enter Rip Taylor. He indeed is legend. And God bless him. We lost him last year, and he is always willing to make himself the butt of every joke, and he was king of that on this show.
Well, let's start with how the show actually was laid out. It was like any other talent show. You had the opening of the show, in the opening of the show, you had Rip Taylor come out with a bevy of beauties and a couple on his arms, and he'd walk down like the catwalk, the runway there. And once he got to the contestants, what happened? He did Rip Taylor. He pulled out a big bag of confetti and just flung it everywhere. Don't care if it gets in people's eyes or mouths. Here, you get confetti, you get confetti, you get confetti. And there was at least even one episode where the audience had confetti with them and started throwing their confetti at Rip Taylor.
It's like, I got you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
It's she was giving confetti everywhere. I'd hate to be the janitorial staff cleaning up.
If there was any more confetti, it would have run for 6 months on Facebook.
Too soon.
I'll tell you this. Rip gave the people what they wanted. They wanted confetti, and he gave them confetti, dang it.
Yes. So after the intro where Rip Taylor covered the audience in confetti and had this bevy of beauties, I mean, he must have had probably a dozen women behind him. Don't know if they were future contestants or past contestants or just hired models, but he had all these women in swimsuits behind him, and then he introduced the celebrities. We'll get to the celebrities in a little bit. There were three, and I believe Chico mentioned this earlier, or maybe it was Greg, before we started recording.
It was me.
They did absolutely nothing.
Yes!
This is the easiest paycheck in Hollywood. They chose the final winner, but other than that, they didn't say a word. They just waved to the audience. They just watched the whole proceedings going on.
I don't even think they chose the winner.
Well, I think it looks like they deliberated, but at the very least, one of the celebrities, I think the one furthest away from the stage, gave either Rip the final winner in an envelope, or he gave it to the sidekick, who we'll get to later on, because I've got stuff to say about the sidekick.
Yeah, but the best part is the best part about this show is the celebrities and their reactions to what the contestants are doing. This is probably the best paycheck in the whole world to be on this show, and you just watch some people do some ridiculous stuff, and it's comedy gold from there.
Yeah.
It's money for nothing, baby.
And your checks for free.
So after we meet the celebrities, we have our introduction of the contestants for the night. They came down a little staircase, generally wearing like dresses, and I wouldn't even say evening dresses. It wasn't anything fancy. And you'd hear Johnny Jacobs, the announcer, saying, "Here's contestant one, you know, Jan Smith from, you know, Poughkeepsie, New York. And she's, you know, 27 years old." So just a basic overview, nothing fancy. And Rip would always, you know, talk with the contestant and have some snappy one-liner at the end, making fun of either the person's where they live, sometimes maybe their ethnicity, nothing too fierce, but always had some quick little one-liner. And then here's contestant two. Same thing. Come down the staircase. Rip says, "Hi, you know, what do you do for a living?" And then he makes some little snappy one-liner or retort, and then repeat for the other six contestants. And then we get to the talent portion. Well, we should put talent in air quotes.
Well, when we say talent, it really is as wild a card as you can get, because they could be genuinely talented, or the kind
of the one that you mentioned earlier, Chico.
Okay. Oh, okay. So on one of the episodes that's on YouTube, we have lovely Rita from Belize, then British Honduras. Her talent was balancing two champagne glasses on her boobs.
Well, she's definitely...
She went on to win the whole thing, by the way.
She definitely has two talents. We know that much.
I can only imagine why she won.
Gwen, Greg, behave. Why did I say Gwen? I don't know.
So, was that the episode that has Peter Lawford as a celebrity? They might explain.
No, the episode I watched had Rosie Greer and...
And Mackenzie Phillips. Yes. Well, don't say the rest of the celebrities, because I know what you're talking about. We'll get through the celebrity rundown in a little bit, or some of the celebrities. So, yeah, the talent competition was... I mean, there are legitimately good talents. You'd have dancers and singers, piano players, people doing, you know, gymnastics or cheerleading. But then you'd have, like, as Chico said, the not really talent, but you know
the
what?
Cutting room floor of America's Got Talent material, basically.
It's the 70s. It's the jiggle factor. I'm going to put champagne glasses on my boobs. Yeah. Only from Chuck Barris. And then after that, we get the swimsuit competition. And, okay, if you say so. Johnny Jacobs would introduce each girl, and he would give their measurements. That isn't a little, invading one's privacy a little bit. Here's your measurements. 34, 24, 32. Maybe this was the Chuck Barris version of the proverbial casting couch. Hmm? Yeah, you know what I mean by that.
Yes, I know what you mean by that.
Okay. I can't not know what you mean by that.
Okay, but yeah, I really think that this was sort of the Chuck Barris version of the casting couch in terms of, okay, here, now we know the measurements of the girl, we know where she lives. I mean, the only thing they didn't like broadcast was her social security number. In addition to the measurements, Johnny Jacobs would always have very comedic lines. I mean, obviously fed to him, but, you know, they'd say, oh, she was born in Arkansas and she spent her first 18 years of life, you know, living on a pig farm. Oh, and she was the main pig or something like that. I mean, sometimes it'd be very sarcastic, some of the comments, you know, very jokingly funny to get a laugh out of the audience. It wasn't totally biographical. There was some comedic factor. And then after each contestant showed off their stuff, if you will, their figure, they stood on the side of the stage against a wall. And then we had a final break, and the judges, quote-unquote, deliberated over a winner. And the winner, as I said, gave some sort of assistant. And this guy, he looked like a cross. He was dressed as a cross between, like, William Shakespeare and one of the Three Musketeers. He had this. Did you look at this, Greg?
He looks like the community theater version of a bard.
Yeah, he's wearing this hat that would be like a Three Musketeers type of hat, and he's wearing like purple suede and velvet, and he's wearing even like purple leggings. He looks like, you know, like one of the Three Musketeers or somebody from Shakespearean times, and he'd run and bring Rip Taylor over the envelope, and he'd rip it open and say, you know, tonight's second place winner or runner up is blank, and then the winner is blank, and then you get into the serenade, and as Rip is serenading, the bard, I think that's what we'll just call him, the bard. The bard rolls a little red carpet down the runway so the day's winner could walk down it. And Rip Taylor adorns the winner of the day with a tiara, a headdress, very reminiscent of something that you would see on the Statue of Liberty, but it's missing one of the spikes, sort of signifying the cheapness of the whole effort. And also, he would give a bouquet, and so not roses, but of like rotten vegetables and cabbage and carrots. Oh. I mean, this is like the epitome of it's showing the cheapness. This is great.
Yeah, yeah. It was a bouquet from the salad bar, a tiara with one of the spikes missing, a dirty robe, a cheap sash, and of course the titular prize of $1.98 all in change,
which Rip Taylor dispensed from a coin dispenser on his belt.
Yes, yeah, yep. he gave the coin. He got the coins out, and he gave it to the contestant. He didn't have a paper dollar bill and some coins. No. He gave him the entire dollar's worth of coins.
Now, the only way this might get better, and I use the word might, is if there's a giant prop check for $1.98 that came out.
It's like, paid to the order of the winner. Memo, winning. Oh, wait.
Do not cash if over $1.98.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. No, that was the Almost Impossible Game Show, by the way. Future installment, the Almost Impossible Game Show.
After Rip Taylor gave the day's winner her prizes and her sash and her rotten vegetables, he would serenade her. And here's that serenade now.
Of the world.
Just brings a tear to your eye, doesn't it, Mike?
It brings a feeling.
It brings something. I don't know about a tear to my eye.
Maybe that was indigestion. I don't know. But in all of this, it's important to remember one thing, and I have it right here, and I had to blow it up after capturing it on my tablet here. Because Game Show Network, when they ran the show, they like to squeeze in Chris Evans and his friends guessing salmonella or botulism. Or anyway.
And you know what's a rip, Chico? We didn't even get to see America's ass from Chris Evans.
No, we did not. Okay, anyway, all of this, we must remember one thing. If you take nothing else from this show, remember this one thing. The preceding program was not a contest and was intended as entertainment only. All winners were selected by the production company.
Well, you mentioned the Game Show Network airings from about 2001 and 2002. As a kid, I actually remember this being rerun on Saturday nights, probably around 1984, 85, maybe as late as 86. And actually, that was sort of the case with a number of the Bears shows from back in the late 70s. Newlywed Game reruns and Dating Game reruns, I remember, were airing on independent television in this area. It would have been probably about 1983, 84-ish.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that much because I remember they would air on, I believe I was living in Kansas City at the time, and they aired either on KSHB 41 back when it was an independent, or KZKC back when it was an independent.
Right, yeah. The Newlywed Game and maybe the Dating Game, I know, aired on WCLQ here, again, like 83, 84. But the $1.98 Beauty Show was one of the early shows that current CBS affiliate and former Fox affiliate WOIO aired when it first launched. I believe it was 84, 85. I think it was 84 when it launched. And that was actually sort of appointment TV for me as a 9 or 10 year old. And that tells you a heck of a lot about me.
It does. It does.
Sadly, yes.
This had it all. This had all the entertainment that you could possibly want in 1978.
And we haven't even gotten to the celebrities.
Oh, let's get
this is the best part.
This is the best part because
this is like a who's who of late 70s. You had some retreads. You had Peter Lawford, but he was making the rounds in the 70s. He played Pyramid at some point in the 70s.
Yeah, and he was also Peter Lawford was also on what we mentioned back in episode 5, the aforementioned pilot episode of Monday Night Quarterback.
And Rosie Grier. And Rosie Grier was definitely a household name, not just from football, but he was even doing acting in the 70s.
Yes, he was.
A young lady at the time, Mackenzie Phillips, who would have been on One Day at a Time.
Right.
J.P. Morgan, who we all know from The Gong Show and other Chuck Barris shows and even some singing. Trini Lopez.
Wait, what?
Trini Lopez. Do you need to look up who Trini Lopez is?
I may have to. The name is familiar, or maybe I was thinking of Trini Alvarado, but anyway. Trini Lopez, American musician.
First album quoted a version of If I Had a Hammer.
There you go. Still with us, by the way.
Like I said, everybody knows who Trini Lopez is.
Next, we have another veteran from the game show circuit, Fred Travellina.
And he probably was in so much pain because he couldn't do any of his impressions. He had to sit down and be quiet.
Again, best job in Hollywood if you could get it in 1978.
And then after Fred Travellina, we had, again, another TV mainstay from pretty much like the 50s through, I would almost say, her death, Dr. Joyce Brothers. I mean, she was on everything. Everything.
She was one of the original people who was on the circuit known for being, well, known.
For being somebody. Well, she was known for more than being known.
Yep.
She did win the big prize on $64,000 question.
Yeah, and that was basically it. She was the Ken Jennings. She was the Ken Jennings back in the day.
Oh, I'm going to disagree with you because Ken Jennings has done far more than that. He's a writer. He's a podcast host.
Yes.
Yeah. He's more than, I mean, he got his popularity from Jeopardy, obviously, but I don't think Joyce Brothers, I'm sure she's written a book or two because, you know, she had that celebrity.
She's totally written a book or two.
Did she have a podcast, though?
Well, Dr. Joyce Brothers, hold up, guys. Dr. Joyce Brothers was in The Naked Gun.
She was.
Yeah, Ken Jennings wasn't. I'll give you that.
maybe if we cast a Naked Gun reboot, maybe we can cast Ken in that.
No, we can't do Naked Gun ever again. No Leslie Nielsen, no sale. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Oh. And then after Dr. Joyce, we had Anson Williams, Patsy from Happy Days.
Yeah.
And Mabel King, who was the mother on What's Happening, I believe.
You are correct, sir.
Okay, I won't double check that. But so, yeah, that was what Mabel King was known for.
Next we have, well, another act perfect for this show. We have Waylon Flowers and Madam.
Who was another fixture from the late 70s and early 80s. Oh, hey. They have their own show, Madam. I don't know if it's a submission, but it should be. As Greg goes through the submission list to see if it's already in there.
I never put that in there. So I'll put it in.
Yeah, Madam.
Well, how many other chances are we going to talk about Waylon Flowers and Madam?
The final Hollywood Squares, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because they were in the center square. Yes.
And that used to be rerun on USA back in like 85 or so. I remember that.
Oh, what wasn't rerun on USA back in 1985?
Dolly 98 Beauty Show, for one. But also, Madam's Place, I believe, had one of the Lander sisters, if not both. So either Audrey or Judy was on there, if not both of them. Sorry, we're doing more show prep as we do the show.
So next we have Morty Allen.
He who recently passed away, but also he of the crazy hair.
I believe this was before he did Pac-Man.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Pac-Man would have been like 83, and this was 78 to 80. So definitely before Pac-Man.
Jamie Farr.
Yeah, from MASH.
Yep.
And every other game show in the 70s and 80s.
And a pilot of many a show, but never getting on air, outside of that one wordplay episode or that one week. And speaking of game shows,
we have Chuck Lorre on this as a panelist here on the $1.98 Beauty Show. Because at this time, Chuck would have been hosting Wheel of Fortune.
Yes, he was.
And then after that, we have Louis Nye, not the science guy.
No, he's another Nye.
And we have another Chuck Barris favorite, the unknown comic, Murray Langston.
Man, you know, it's got to be very tough, you know, with those facials, because all you could see with unknown comic is that dang paper bag.
But, you know, the paper bag fits the $1.98 motif. Think about it.
Oh, it does.
And it makes his job that much easier.
Yeah, because then we don't have to see what he really thinks about these crappy performances.
Exactly.
Maybe we do. He just writes it on his bag.
How can he write on that bag?
I don't know. He's got other talents, doesn't he?
Speaking of talents, Steve Garvey.
Oh, I know why he's on this show.
No.
Oh,
we're going to step right into this one there, Chico. Why is he on the show, Greg?
Because he had sex with a lot of women.
Not untrue. He got a lot of babies. And then I'm going to wrap up with three celebrities that I purposely save for last because one of them is, he's sort of a celebrity, and the other two are like, what hole did you drag these folks out of? The first one is Dorothy L'Amour. Dorothy L'Amour was in the Road films with Bing Crosby and Bob Hope back in the 40s and 50s. So, and I'm not discrediting her. She's obviously a very popular actress, but it's like a name that I really wouldn't expect to see on a game show in 1978 is Dorothy L'Amour. We also had Patty Andrews from the Andrews Sisters, and really, unless there was a disco version of Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy from Company B in the 70s, that's like going back a generation and a half, almost two generations, for heaven's sakes. Because Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy was World War II, like 41. So, yeah, let's get somebody on here who's popular for a song for the boys fighting overseas back in the early 40s, 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago at that point. And then this one puzzled me, but after thinking about it, you know, he is a semi-celebrity, if you will. Roger Owens, and you're probably saying, who is Roger Owens?
Who is Roger Owens?
Who is Roger Owens?
Why, I'm glad you asked. He's the peanut man at Dodger Stadium. He's been on Johnny Carson. He's been serving peanuts at Dodger Stadium now for 60 years. He's the one that is like really accurate and does like the trick throws behind the back and through the legs and all that. He was a judge on the $1.98 Beauty Show. And also when he was shown, when Rip Taylor announced him, what did he do? He threw a bag of peanuts in the audience.
Bravo. That is terrific.
He's living up to his name. He's the peanut man. So, yeah, easiest gig in Hollywood. If you were somebody who needed a paycheck, even if you were a peanut vendor at Dodger Stadium, you were on the $1.98 Beauty Show. The $1.98 Beauty Show, though, did give us some celebrities. Not immediate celebrities, but still celebrities in their own right. Probably the most famous one is Sandra Bernhardt.
Yes.
She of the Gap Teeth and the Roseanne Show. She was on the $1.98 Beauty Show. We also had Teresa Ganzel, a very popular name in TV. One of the best pyramid players there ever was. And she was on the Carson Show, on the Tonight Show. She was Art Fearn's sidekick for the Tea Time movies. She was the Tea Time movie girl after Carol Wayne. And she was also on Future Entry, The Duck Factory.
She was on The Duck Factory.
Wow. Yeah. And also we had Rhonda Shear, who was known for one thing, really. People of a certain age would know who she is. People older than probably about, gosh, I would hope about 30 or so, 35. Because if you were 35 now and you saw this back in the 90s, you were a bad person. No, it's just inappropriate for people that young. But she was, well, I'll let Rhonda say it.
USA. All night.
Up,
all night.
And that, I think, is sadly like where the only thing she's known
adult
for.
Adult stuff.
And then the other person with a game show connection is Lou Mulford, who was actually a model on Sale of the Century back in the 80s.
This was before the Geico commercial, right?
Geico commercial was 2010s and Sale of the Century is 1980s. Yes, the math works out. So, yeah, there are actually people who sort of, this might have been like a launch board.
By the way, Lou Mulford, she has her own YouTube channel. Really good if you want to see what proper demos look like.
And if you want to see Rhonda Shear doing Up All Night, Rhonda Shear has a YouTube channel with a lot of that Up All Night footage. Just her sitting around in slinky garb, her big flowing blonde hair, the big puffy blonde hair of the early 90s and late 80s. And she's talking about these campy, softcore porn-ish movies that USA used to show on Friday and Saturday nights. And then after she describes, you know, her little the movie or the scenario she's in, she does her little Up All Night. We don't know if Teresa Ganzel or if Sandra Bernhardt have any YouTube channels. Sorry.
I really do hope Teresa Ganzel has a YouTube channel.
And she better have every episode of the Duck Factory on there.
Oh, yeah, I hope so.
And every time she was on the Carson show and did the Tea Time Lady. Oh, I'm sorry. I love the Tea Time Lady and Art Fern, the Slauson cutoff. Now get off and cut your Slauson and cut off your Slauson. Oh, my gosh.
Remember, if you show your Slauson in public, it'll get you 5 to 10.
And if it's long, maybe you'll get 15 to 20. No. one thing I want to mention before we close out the show, there was actually an episode of the $1.98 Beauty Show which had 7 contestants.
And this 7 is, contestants?
7!
This is clearly staged. Because what happened is it was whittled down to 6. What happened is one of the contestants was doing some sort of act, singing or dancing or something in that realm. Uh-huh. And she was wearing essentially like a wedding gown kind of mixed with like lingerie. So she was sort of like, so it wasn't a full wedding gown with the full train. It was more like lingerie that looked like a wedding gown in terms of being white. And I think she had even like the veil and the headdress on. And so Rip Taylor came back from the commercial after all 7 contestants had done their talent acts and said that whatever contestant she was, I think it was contestant 3, ran off the stage in embarrassment after her performance and couldn't be found. So we're going to move on with the 6 contestants that are left. So yeah, that's actually on YouTube. An episode that started with 7 contestants and then mysteriously, one of the contestants ran away off the stage, out of the stage, in embarrassment.
Oh, my God.
Well, they put a little monkey wrench in things. I mean, it mixed things up a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you want to talk about interesting little monkey wrenches? Tell them about the guy in drag they had that one time.
Well, there was a guy in drag, and I think it was, and I'm not 100% sure of this, but if you see it, it's in the opening credits of the show. I'm pretty sure that guy is Gene Gene the Dancing Machine.
Yes. Oh, I am almost certain of it.
And I never saw this episode either on GSN or as a kid, but I would assume it's either a gag or, yeah, maybe he just came down as like a surprise or an April Fool's or something. Who knows? But yeah, it's in the opening credits. You see Gene Gene the Dancing Machine. He came down the staircase, and he's wearing a dress and a pillbox hat and appeared to be one of the contestants, but was he? We really will never know.
Oh,
well,
God.
That was the $1.98 Beauty Show.
Yeah, what can I say except there was so much going on with this. And when I say so much, the only thing that can possibly be said about the $1.98 beauty show, it was a thing on TV.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 22, submission 219, Doctor Who Dimensions in Time. It aired on the BBC on November 26th and 27th of 1993 as a two-part one-off special.
For the 1993 BBC See Children in Need telephone.
Thank you.
Insert Doctor Who theme in your own head because we're not playing it.
Okay. I'm Chico. That's Greg. That's Mike. And this is in celebration of the new season that just dropped on the BBC. We have a commemorative entry. Yes, Doctor Who Dimensions in Time, which was done for the 1993 Children in Need campaign that the BBC had at the time.
And also to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Doctor Who, being that it premiered in 1963.
And that, yeah, and this was about 4 years after it was canceled for the first time, which explains why they have the 1989 opening. Brief synopsis for Mike. Time-traveling alien can shift forms, travels around time and space in a TARDIS, which is a space-time ship that is permanently disguised as a British police box.
I know what that is, Chico. Oh my gosh.
Come on, you don't... He has his Doctor Who credentials. Come on.
I've played the Doctor Who pinball machine. Thank you very much.
Anybody can play the Doctor Who pinball machine.
Does everyone know that the first Doctor you pick in the Doctor Who pinball machine is the sixth Doctor? No.
No, because I usually go 1, 2, 3. I don't care about what Doctor to pick.
Oh.
Everyone picks the sixth Doctor first, dang it.
Thank you. Oh my god, thank you very much, Greg.
That's why I've only gotten 2 billion and 3 billion on that game. If I picked Dr. Six first, maybe I'd get like 5 billion.
But yeah, this was a crossover event with EastEnders and also with Noel's House Party? Huh?
Yeah, Noel Edmonds of who you best know for the UK version of Deal or No Deal, probably, was the host of both parts of this special. He did the introductions for parts 1 and part 2.
But wait, Greg, hold on. You mentioned Deal or No Deal. You forgot to mention his best show of all, which, by the way, is coming in 3 weeks. Three short weeks. future Wait, entry
hold
in
up.
The first what? Week of February.
Cheap, cheap, cheap.
That's right. This is not going to be the last time we talk about Noel Edmonds on this show, baby.
Not nope. even the last time in the next month. Yes.
Noel introduces the spec. When we first saw the segment on YouTube, we watched see Noel. He's reading a paper. He's wearing 3D glasses. Because, folks, this was broadcast in 3D.
Yes, it was worth looking like a complete and utter nutcase. Just saying.
So there's a ring at the doorbell, and who could that be? He opens the door. Noel opens the door, and who? Guess who it is? It's John Pertwee as the Third Doctor, and John Pertwee says he just got back from the year 2013, and he found out that Noel is still on television.
Not untrue. I was hoping that when the doorbell rang. Boy, who's at the door? I was hoping it'd be Secretariat.
Boss.
You know, Mike Francesa meant Secretariat.
Hey, I met the Fourth Doctor, okay? He was a very weird guy. He always had his scarf around, and yeah, he was very weird.
Inside jokes are the best jokes. Okay, so the Third Doctor, he's there to introduce the clip. And the clips by themselves run about 7 or 8 minutes. Together, it's about 20 minutes. Because, again, you have the intro and the outro of both clips. And it's on YouTube if you want to take a look at it. But it is... Greg, help me out here.
It's something.
Yeah, it is indeed something. I mean, it's not exactly old school Who, which, by the way, has its own channel on Pluto, if you are into that sort of thing. But it wouldn't really lay the frame for what would be to come about 3 years later with the TV movie, or 12 years later with the revival series. But it was a nice little refreshing bit. It was 20 minutes of fan service, basically.
Yes.
Because you have we have the various incarnations of the Doctor. And not just one companion, because he always travels with a companion. But some of the most memorable companions. I have. Are you ready for this? Yeah. Sophie Aldred as Ace, John Leeson as K-9, Bonnie Langford as Mel Bush, Nicola Bryant as faux American Perry Brown, Sarah Sutton as Nyssa, Lala Ward as Romana, Louise Jameson as Leela, Elizabeth Sladen, God rest her soul, as Sarah Jane Smith, Richard Franklin is Captain Mike Yates, Carolyn John is Liz Shaw, Deborah Watling is Victoria Waterfield, Carol Ann Ford as the first companion, Susan Foreman, and Nicholas Courtney as the Brigadier.
And we'll talk about a significant moment in Doctor Who history when the Brigadier shows up later on.
And there were all of the Doctors and all of the companions were being trapped in a 20-year time frame thanks to another renegade time lady, the Rani, played by the late, great Kate O'Mara at this point.
So the Rani was introduced in the Colin Baker era of the show in The Mark of the Rani and later appeared in the Seventh Doctor in the regeneration story, The Time in the Rani.
Yeah. And so you have the Doctor and the companions jumping from time to time and also encountering half of the cast of EastEnders for some reason. But before that, Tom Baker was in front of a green screen to deliver this message. Which in retrospect makes absolutely no sense, but here it is. And if Tom Baker is listening, I do apologize for the piss poor impersonation here. Mayday. Mayday. This is an urgent message for all of the doctors. It's vitally important that you listen carefully to me for once. Our whole existence is being threatened by a renegade Time Lord known only as the Ronnie. She hates me. She even hates children. Oh boy. It gets better, folks. Two of my earlier selves have already been snared in her vicious trap. The grumpy one and the flautist, do you remember? She wants to put us out of action, lock us away in a dreary backwater of London's East End, trapped in a time loop in perpetuity. Her evil is all around us. I can hear the heartbeat of a killer. She's out there somewhere. We must be on our guard. And we must stop her before she destroys all my other selves. Oh. Good luck, my dears.
She even hates children. What does that have to do with anything?
Because it's a children in need special. That's why.
I get that, but why is it important to know she hates children?
It just is. If we didn't know this, then there would be absolutely no proper context. She'd probably be tearing off that bear's head off.
The poor BBC Children in Need bear with his one eye.
Is that right?
All right. So we start with the Seventh Doctor and Ace because, of course, at the time, Sylvester McCoy was still technically the current Doctor.
Again, this was three years before the movie. Which was a good movie, by the way.
So we have the Seventh Doctor and Ace, and they're confused when the TARDIS lands in Greenwich near the Cuddy Sark, thanks to the Ronnie's attack on the TARDIS. So the Doctor finds a newspaper showing the year to be 1973, but before he can make any conclusions, the Ronnie causes time to jump. And then Ace finds herself in Albert Square in 1993 with the Sixth Doctor, played by Colin Baker. EastEnders cast member Sanji tries to sell Ace some new clothes from his stall, and when his wife Gitta tells the Sixth Doctor that it's going to be all the rage in 1994, the Ronnie jumps time again.
Uh-huh. And now we enter the Third Doctor with Mel appearing in their place and questioning an old Pauline Fowler and Kathy Beale on when they are. They reply, it's 2013, which, by the way, Noel Edmonds, still on television. And then they jump back to 1973 when Pauline and Kathy remember the assassination of President Kennedy, and Kathy tells off a young Ian Beale, with the Sixth Doctor appearing alongside Susan Foreman, who wonders what happens to her doctor, which, if you remember, was Bill Hartnell, the First Doctor.
And of course, as we saw in the beginning, the Ronnie has trapped the First and Second Doctor.
Well, their heads anyway.
Yeah, at least their disembodied heads.
Yeah.
So we go into another time jump to 2013, where Susan changes into Sarah Jane Smith, and the Doctor changes from the Sixth to the Third Doctor. They start to piece together what is happening to them, but the Ronnie lets loose her menagerie of specimens, including a Cyberman, Fifi, from the Seventh Doctor serial, The Happiness Patrol, a Sea Devil, an Orgon, and a Time Lord from Gallifrey in the next time jump. Meanwhile, in 1993, the Fifth Doctor, Nyssa, and Perry are attacked by the Ronnie's menagerie, and after they try to warn Pat Butcher of the danger, the Ronnie stops them outside the Queen Vic. And this is where Part 1 comes to an end. Now, at the end of Part 1, viewers were asked to phone in and vote for which EastEnders character would save the Doctor at the start of Part 2. Two versions of the opening scene in Part 2 were filmed. one featuring Mandy, and one featuring Big Ron. The £101,000 raised from phone calls went to children in need, and the result of the vote was announced prior to the screening of Part 2 on Noel's House Party. The version featuring Mandy was broadcast after it won 56% of the vote.
Because who wants to be helped by a person named Big Ross?
Big Ron!
Big Ron, sorry. Who wants to be helped by a person named Big Ron?
I would like to be helped by a person named Big Ron.
I have no say in the matter.
I'd get help from a guy named Big Mike before I get help from a guy named Big Ron.
Be careful
what you wish for.
Hey, Mike, wait a second. Mike, what was your nickname again? Big Papa Mike.
Oh, moving on.
hold on. Okay, all right. You know what? You know what, guys? I would rather be helped by a bot. You know what, guys? I'd rather be helped by a guy named Big Papa Klaus.
Mm-hmm.
So now we get into Part 2. In 1993, after the Fifth Doctor changed to the Third Doctor in the next time jump, with Liz Shaw, the Ronnie took control of Liz's mind. As Mandy Salter tries to stop the Ronnie, Captain Mike Yates of UNIT comes in with Bessie to save the Third Doctor and get him to the Brigadier, who is waiting for them.
Bessie, by the way, is the Who-mobile.
Yes, the Third Doctor's vehicle. So after another time jump, the Doctor changes into the Sixth Doctor, and after he says goodbye to the Brigadier, time jumps again. Now, this is a notable moment that I want to share with you, because it's the first and only time on screen that the Sixth Doctor is with the Brigadier, because the Brigadier did not appear in the Sixth Doctor's era. He appeared in the Fifth Doctor's era in Matter and Undead, and he appeared in Battlefield in the Seventh Doctor era, but he didn't appear in the Sixth Doctor. So it does mark a notable moment, being that the Brigadier is on screen with the Sixth Doctor.
I know. After all of this, they would meet again in several Big Finish audio dramas.
Yes, The Spectre of Lanyon Moore, by the way, which is only $2.99 on Big Finish. So if you want to download that after the show, it's a very cheap price, though.
So. Yep. So after the Doctor and the Brigadier parts ways, Phil and Grant Mitchell are at the Arches, and they find Romana looking for the Doctor. But they point her to Dr. Harold Legg, wrong Doctor. As Romana walks past the Queen Vic, the Ronnie captures her in front of Frank Butcher. Now all they're missing is a human. Well, all the Ronnie is missing is a human. So she can take over the time tunnel and take over all of reality. Back in 1973, the Third Doctor explains to Victoria Waterfield who the Ronnie was and thinks that her control is breaking down as they return to the TARDIS. The Seventh Doctor lands the TARDIS in 1993, where Leela escapes from the Ronnie after being cloned in the form of Romana. This results in an additional Time Lord brain imprint being left on the computer inside the Ronnie's TARDIS, which is like this sort of pillar-looking thing. Sort of runic pillar, Greg?
Yeah, and the Ronnie's TARDIS also has the round things.
Yeah, they have the round thing. Ronnie's a big fan of the round things. So instead of a human brain that she needed, she has a second Time Lord brain, which gives the Seventh Doctor, Ace, and K-9 the edge needed to rig up a device to overload it, sending the Ronnie into the time tunnel where she had trapped the First and Second Doctors, and freeing the Doctor's other selves from the loop to return to their respective home eras, or whatever eras they were captured from. As the Seventh Doctor and Ace leave in the TARDIS for further adventures, the Doctor observes, certainly we... are difficult to get rid of. I can't, and that was Dimensions in Time, and I can't help but think that that last line was sort of a backhanded swipe at the BBC.
Yeah, I gotta think John Nathan Turner was given a shoot comment over to the Beeb at the cancellation with that.
Yep.
Take that, Michael Grade.
So, important notes about this, because this marks a whole lot of eerie transitions and a whole lot of historical moments and just a lot of history being made in these 20 minutes. First of all, we find out that Noel Edmonds is still on television in 2013. Probably doing something involving suitcases. I don't know.
Well, it's a good thing that the third Doctor didn't arrive from 2017. He could have told Noel Edmonds, yeah, I just watched this ridiculous show where you're like in a store and it's called Cheap, Cheap, Cheap.
Future entry, by the way.
But more about that next month.
John Pertwee, who is the third Doctor and also the father of Alfred, who is played by Sean Pertwee on Gotham.
Gotham, yes.
He would die 3 years later, so this is his actual final role as the Doctor. And again, he proves that he still has what it took. Okay, so Tom Baker, on the other hand, he would appear over and over and over again in various media as the Doctor, and in the 50th anniversary special, he was, I don't know if he was the Doctor, but he did make an appearance with then Doctor Matt Smith in that final sort of scene with the painting. Go back and watch it. It is one of the best scenes, I think, ever to come from the Stephen Moffat era of Doctor Who.
Yeah, and it's great because it implies, was that the Doctor after he's done with time traveling and all that? After he's saved everything? He just decides, oh, one day I'm just going to be a curator at an art museum and just hang out, do nothing.
Watch this film. Or watch this painting. It's not really a painting. Bigger on the inside. Okay, it is also the final on-screen appearance of Colin Baker as the Sixth Doctor, to which I say... Yeah, every science fiction franchise has a red-headed stepchild. The Doctor Who version is Colin Baker.
And unless you listen to Big Finish.
Yeah. But judging strictly from the television show, yeah. It is also the last appearance as Carolyn John as Liz Shaw, who died in 2012, and Deborah Watling as Victoria Waterfield, who died in 2017. Sophie Aldred, so it was almost a joke that Sophie Aldred was actually on that special because she was the companion ace, and at the same time she was also Susie on EastEnders at the time.
Yeah, you think they'd have like a line that said, you know, you look awfully familiar.
Yeah, sort of like what the Love Boat did back in the day when you had Florence Henderson and Robert Reed in two different stories, and they just happened to run into each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It would also not be the last appearance of Elizabeth Sladen, who would later go on to join the David Tennant era of the series in the same role as Sarah Jane Smith, because
Sarah Jane Smith appears in the season 2 episode of the new series School Reunion. And, of course, she later goes on to have her own series spun off in the Sarah Jane Adventures. And, of course, she later comes back in the big finale of season 4, where everyone from the past companions, the revived series of Doctor Who, from Torchwood to Sarah Jane Adventures, all cross over in one big event with Davros.
Yep. Well, again... Great episode there. But unfortunately, that would be the last appearance of Elizabeth Sladen, as she had died, I want to say, a year later.
No, because that would have been around 2011, 2012, because I know Matt Smith appeared like on the last season of Sarah Jane Adventures as the 11th Doctor.
Ah. Well, she died sometime after that. So... Okay, and again, Greg, you said this would be the only time in which Nicholas Courtney and or his character, the Brigadier, appeared with the Sixth Doctor on screen, but it would not be the only time that they would meet, because they are also on the Big Finish audio dramas.
Yep.
And
I already mentioned it, so I don't have anything else to say.
There you go. Okay, now John Nathan Turner, he was the one who wrote the special and actually approached Anthony Ainley to reprise his role as the Master, but he turned it down. But reportedly, I say reportedly because Ainley reportedly denied this, insisting if he were asked, he would have had no hesitation in appearing.
So another person that they considered getting for this special was Michael Goh. Now, Michael Goh, you might remember as Batman's butler, Alfred, in the Michael Keaton / Val Kilmer / George Clooney Batman movies from 1989 to 1997. He originally played the Celestial Toymaker in the First Doctor serial of the same name. And again, John Nathan Turner was turned down, this time by Michael Goh. And then finally, Kate O'Mara was asked if she would like to reprise her role of the Ronnie for this special, which she readily agreed.
Yes, and she was joined by Samuel West, who played her sidekick, Sirian, who was named after the original intended actor, Sir Ian McKellen.
Although later, Sir Ian McKellen would go on to be on Doctor Who, well, not so much beyond, but his voice would appear on Doctor Who as the voice of the Great Intelligence in the 2012 Doctor Who Christmas special as the Great Intelligence.
Okay, now, the Daleks were also supposed to appear, and you'd probably be able to sell this episode if the Daleks were to appear, because, I mean, come on, the Daleks. But the segment was pulled after a dispute with Dalek creator Terry Nation over payments. The segment would have seen Peter Davison facing up against them again in the street scene in the 1984 serial The Resurrection of the Daleks.
Oh, wow. A dispute with Terry Nation over payments? Man, what a surprise.
I am shocked. This is my shocked face. Okay, and interesting, this was a complete and total charity case, what they did here, because everybody involved, from the actors of the crew to the people over at the BBC who made the 3D effect and made the glasses, who, if you remember the clip, looked incredibly Elton John-ish. They look like Elton John's glasses. Everything was donated as a benefit to children in need. The crew gave the services especially for children in need, which probably explains that throwaway line by Tom Baker in the beginning. And they waived their fees on the condition that Dimensions in Time would never be repeated or sold on home video for profit. For that same reason, the story has and never will appear as an extra on a DVD release. But it's on YouTube if you know where you can find it, so.
Man, this was something else.
Else. Yeah, this was something else. I'll tell you something else. 13.8 million people watched the first part, and 13.6 million people watched the second part. So they were two of the most highly watched episodes of Doctor Who ever produced, but a far cry from the 16.1 million viewers of City of Death, Part 4.
which was the Fourth Doctor serial, written by the late, great Douglas Adams.
Yep. Which you might remember, Mike, as the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I knew that.
And also features a great cameo in that serial from John Cleese.
Yep.
I mean, you'd think with the $13.6 million, the BBC would have seen those numbers and thought, man, you know what? People are hungry for some new Doctor Who. You know, we got to bring this show back. I mean, it wouldn't be done. I mean, if Doctor Who would kind of come back a couple years later, but it wouldn't be from the BBC. That would kind of be through another company in North America. But that's another story that we'll save for another time.
Yeah. Which also was a pretty solid story. And after that, of course, came 2005 and Christopher Eccleston and Billy Piper and Rose, and the rest, as they say, is time and relative dimension in space.
Well, or as someone else would say, now you know the rest of the story.
Thoughts, Mike, now that you know the story of dimensions in time?
I have one comment. The 49ers won 27-10.
Wow, this doesn't date this episode one bit.
Well, what can I say? This episode was about time.
Hey, who needs a backlog of entries? We get these things churned, baby. You don't have a two or three week waiting turnaround time. We get these churned one by one. Boom, 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 boom. It's sort of like John and Kate just pushing out kids.
Oh God!
Oh Christ!
Oh wait. There was another one. And who knows? Here's the thing. There was another one-off that we may choose to revisit in the future. Doctor Who and the Curse of the Fatal Death in 1999.
Yes, we have to cover that. How do we not think of that?
Put it on the list.
Put it on the list. There you go. Again, that is another story for another time. But for now, Doctor Who, Dimensions in Time for Children in Need. A solid but wasted effort on the BBC's part to bring Doctor Who back for a new generation.
Yeah, we had John Pertwee, we had Noel Edmonds, we had Tom Baker in front of a green screen. We had the cast of EastEnders. We had the Sixth Doctor meeting the Brigadier. We had the Ronnie. Doctor Who Dimensions in Time. It was a thing on TV. So that was Doctor Who Dimensions in Time, and it had everything from EastEnders to the Doctors and Noel Edmonds. And believe me, this won't be, as we discussed the last time, we'll be talking about Noel Edmonds, because he'll be coming up in the very, very near future. But in the meantime, we have some good shows on the Place to Be Nation pop feed this week. For example, on the Brother Sister We Watch podcast, Kevin and Mary return for another episode as they looked at episodes 9 and 10 of The Office's fifth season, Frame Toby and the Surplus. They tackle several topics this week, including Kevin's boredom with Pam, Jim making a major life decision without Pam's knowledge, Michael's selfishness again rearing its head, and the return of everyone's favorite fresh and blood Eeyore. In the ninth episode of The Year in Pop, co-hosts Andy Afferton and Scott Criscolo are joined by J. Arsenio D'Amato and George Rubino to discuss all the goings-on in the news, sports, TV, music, and movies for the year 1980. The guys talk in depth about the Rubik's Cube, the start of the New York Islanders dynasty, the No Moss fight, the Miracle on Ice, the Who Shot JR phenomenon, the death of John Lennon, 9 to 5, and Xanadu.
Also, be sure to check out the PTBN Wrestling Feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from the day's WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Wrestling Warzone, Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTBN NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today. And, of course, there's a new episode of Jeff Learns Wrestling that just came out the other day as I'm recording this. And you can hear Jeff's amazing, incredible story about his quest to get stickers for all 32 NFL teams. It is something to behold. What an amazing, amazing story. I hope you get all those stickers, Jeff. I really do. And while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well, as it is the home of Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, Freak Out, Drive-In, Telling Stories, and more. We have officially kicked off our 2020 stretch project, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do your research, promote matches, and build your list. Conversation rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. And be sure not to forget to check out placetobenation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes, bringing you articles on topics in the world of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including trends, SmackDown on Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget to check out veteran columns like Glenn Butler's weekly Walk Around the Web. And if you are doing online shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the PTBN homepage, or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon. It helps out PTBN at no cost to you. So now let's continue on with our final topic of the day as we look back at the pop culture phenomenon of 2003. That was Joe Millionaire.
Episode 23, Submission 070, Joe Millionaire. Hi, everybody. I'm Chico Alexander, alongside Mike Klass and Craig Diener, as always. And this week, we have the true story of a real fake.
Yes.
He's a phony!
A big, fat phony! Yeah, this was probably the hit of 2003. Pretty much maybe one of the big shows in the 2000s, I have to say.
Well, yeah.
So hyped. I mean,
how hype was it
on this?
Yeah, imagine, if you will, somebody, Mike Darnell, watching an episode of The Bachelor on ABC and thinking to himself, you know, I could bring this to Fox, but I need a hook. I need something that will, you know, put Fox all over this show. Then somebody, I'm guessing either Chris Cohen or Jean-Michel Michonneau, who are partners in Rocket Science Laboratories, who produced this show, thought, hey, what if we take this good-looking guy who makes about $30,000, $40,000, whatever.
No, I thought it was like $16,000.
$16,000.
Yeah, he was not making that much money.
No, he wasn't making that much money. So he was making like $16,000. And what if we take this guy, doesn't make much, comes from, he's a real salt-of-the-earth guy, nice-looking, really good with people, and tell all of these gold-digging bimbos that he is worth millions. The kids will eat it up. Mike Darnell approves the show, and casting begins. And who do they find? Evan Marriott. Full name, Evan Wallace Marriott. This is important. And they, and all these ladies, I forgot how many, but all of these ladies are whisked away to a palatial chateau in France, where they meet not Evan Marriott, Evan Wallace. He has inherited millions of dollars, and he is searching for a potential bride. All of these women are taken on exquisite dates, but in the back of their minds, they're being, well, not so much in the back of their mind, in the front of their mind, and all over the place, being thrown reminders of just how incredibly rich he is.
Well, to answer your question, Chico, Truth by Consensus Wikipedia says that there were 20 contestants, and this show lasted, well, Wikipedia says 1 season, 6 episodes, but in actuality it was 2 seasons and 18 episodes, 8 episodes in season 1 and 10 episodes in season 2. So take it with a grain of salt, everybody. But yeah, Joe Millionaire, so he was a construction worker, but not even that. It was found out, I think it was sometime during the show, I think it was a smoking gun discovery, that Evan Marriott was at one time an underwear model.
Yes, an underwear model for California Muscle.
It was a thong on TV for sure.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh,
Jesus.
Hey, it's a continuation of a joke from last week. Yay!
Banana hammock. Anyway.
Oh,
oh.
Now that that image is in your head, let's go into...
Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy that image is in my head. Yeah, thank you very much, Trico.
Okay, so... Joe Millionaire, all of these women are just lambasted with reminders of just how well off this guy is supposed to be. People, whereas in The Bachelor, those who were chosen to stay got roses, and Joe Millionaire, everybody who stayed got jewelry. And the longer you stayed, Ooh. The more exquisite the jewelry got.
Dude, that almost sounds like a match game question. On The Bachelor, we got roses, but Joe Millionaire is so rich. How rich is he? We all got blanks. We all got Rolls Royces. Oh. I'm sorry, that's just the first thing that came to my mind when you said that. How rich is he?
We all got... emeralds, rubies, stocks in U.S. steel.
And the losers got rhinestones and zirconium.
Yeah.
I can see them just like going to the corner pawn shop. How much can I get for these stones?
Interesting you admit. Wait, you're getting ahead of ourselves.
Oh,
here,
I'm right. Sorry. I apologize.
Yeah. So, here we are, and... I guess we don't have much in the way of descriptions for each of the episodes, but yeah, it began with Evan's butler, Paul Hogan, who, by the way, is not that guy, but another guy.
No, not Crocodile Dundee. It's another Australian named Paul Hogan.
Yeah. It's another Australian named Paul Hogan, who is, by the way, an actual, factual butler who, by the way, loves cognac.
And I gotta say, this is the reason why I watched Joe Millionaire is because of Paul Hogan, the glue that brought this show together.
Well, it certainly wasn't Alex McLeod because she was, well...
Oh, yeah.
Who's
that girl? Yeah, if my dad was watching this show, she'd say, "Oh, this woman, she's like a C-list." That Paul Hogan.
She was the original host of Trading Spaces. She would be a TLC list.
Oh, no. Thanks for stepping over my joke.
Sorry.
But yeah, my dad would probably say, "Oh yeah, that Paul Hogan. He's so great. It's like Alex McLeod. What's she doing? She should get out of there. She provides nothing."
Which really, she did do nothing, because it says again on Truth by Consensus Wikipedia, she appeared on the season, not per episode, on the season for about a total of 5 minutes.
Hey, still longer than Kelly Marie Tran screen time in The Rise of Skywalker. Oh.
Boo!
Someone will have to explain that to me later, but okay.
Go to your room and think about what you've done, Greg Diener. Anyway, Alex McLeod didn't really do much. Paul Hogan was basically carrying the franchise when Evan Marriott wasn't carrying the franchise. And let's be completely honest. Evan Marriott was he was good peeps.
Yes.
He was easy on the eyes for the ladies, for the guys like you and me who believe that they have a chance at anything. He showed that, you know, you could be humble and you could be yourself and people will resonate with that.
Yeah, and by no means was he brash, not at all. He played the classy millionaire to the hilt.
He was classy.
Yeah, he was like the Monty Brewster of the 2000s.
Yeah. But let's not let the facts get in the way of good editing. Case in points, the runner-up Sarah Koser and Evan on their private date where they go into the forest and nothing happened.
What?!
Supposedly,
they go into the forest. Wink, wink. Nothing happens, supposedly. Wink, wink. Not say it no more. But because this is a show on Fox, something had to happen. So the folks in editing made something happen.
Damn, those are some good CGI effects.
Oh my god. This was probably like early 2000s. Like CGI. It wasn't quite the Marvel Studios CGI where they have like freaking Robert Downey Jr. looking like he just came off the set of Weird Science.
Okay, well, let's go back to Truth by Consensus Wikipedia here. In the VH1 program Reality TV Secrets Reveal, she alleges that her statement, "Let's go somewhere quiet," was in fact spoken while she was receiving a back massage from another female contestant, and that the producers dubbed it in during post-editing and added suggestive sound effects and subtitles. The show's editors corroborated this story later in an interview for Radar Magazine.
Wait, you mean that stuff on reality TV isn't necessarily 100% real?
Like, here's the thing,
Chico, I'm using your line. I'm shocked. This is my shocked face.
Now I don't know what to believe anymore, guys.
I don't believe in nothing no more.
No, I can't believe television would lie to me, guys. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with myself now. I'm just...
Hey, Greg, spoiler. Ken Jennings is a lie.
What?
You're handling it very well. It's just a figment of your imagination. It's all a figment of Tommy Westfall's imagination. Let's go back to episode 13.
Oh. Yeah.
So the Jeopardy Goat Tournament was all just Tommy Westfall screwing with us.
Exactly. Chad Allen had to do something.
Yeah.
Well, that explains why Brad less than every daily double.
Oh, spoiler if you haven't seen it. Sorry.
So now that we know how it all played out, or in this particular case, didn't play out, how did it all end? Well, we're down to our final two, which is Sarah and Zora Andrich. He sits them both down in the parlor and says, "I am not a millionaire. I am not worth $7 billion. I'm not worth $7 million. I'm not worth $7,000. I'm a foreman for a construction company." And the genuine consensus seems to be, okay.
Right. Yeah, you didn't want to meet him for his money, right? You really cared about him.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I'll never forget. Back in the day, we're going back to the ancient times, folks. The days of AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh,
me and Mike were watching this. as the finale happened, and we were laughing our asses off when it was revealed, when he revealed to Zora and Sarah that he was not a millionaire, and we were just crying, laughing with those AOL instant messenger emoticons.
Those were good old days.
Those were the good old days.
I miss those.
Yeah. But, now that we're done talking about AOL.
We're not done.
I know. I didn't say we were done.
We're done with Joe Millionaire proper, but there's two footnotes we need to add.
Let's talk about footnotes.
Hold up. I know what footnote you're going to add.
I think you may know both of them.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the footnotes. Go ahead.
So Evan Marriott didn't necessarily leave the limelight after Joe Millionaire was done. A year later in 2004, he actually hosted a show on GSN, Game Show Network, called Fake a Date. Hey, guys. Got to go on the list, right?
I'm putting it on the list right now.
All right. Again, more show prep within the show. Don't mind us. Fake a Date. I remember seeing that like once or twice. That was abysmal. Abysmal.
I'm so glad. So glad I didn't have GF this time.
Mm-hmm.
But also, and I think this is where Greg thought I was going to go. What was I going to say, Greg?
Were we going to talk about him being in Donruss Americana?
You're darn right I was going to talk about him being in Donruss Americana.
Oh, yeah!
So now, a clear 4 years after Joe Millionaire finished, Donruss, which is now Panini America, released a set of entertainment cards, trading cards, called Americana. And Greg knows this. This is like one of my favorite sets of all time. And one of the people in the 100-card base set is Evan Marriott. And I showed this to Greg and Chico a couple of months ago, I think when this show first came up. Back in the day, back in 2007, I pulled an Evan Marriott used shirt swatch or some sort of used clothing swatch card, and I still have it.
You still have the Evan Marriott used swatch card?
I showed you a photograph of it a couple months ago. Yeah, I still have it. And he did autograph versions, and it has some rarity. I don't know the exact number. I don't have the card with me. It's in one of my card boxes behind me. But I think it was no more than maybe about 250 made. So if you're dying to get a piece of Evan Marriott, oh, I just thought of something, guys. It's a used swatch card. What if for heaven's sakes, what if it's a swatch of some of that California Muscle underwear?
Hold
up, guys. Hold up. Because you're not even gonna believe this. But I don't think you guys know this. But 2 months ago, I bought it for one of the 100 of the Evan Marriott jersey swatch whatever autograph things on eBay. I think I told you, Mike.
Oh, boy.
Hope you didn't pay too much for it.
No, I probably paid like $5.
Well, now you can sell yours for 15, Mike.
Oh, jeez, that's so
great. Just sell this from California Muscle.
You think I'm selling this? No, baby, this is the retirement plan.
You damn right.
So you're probably wondering, what happened to the lady that Evan picked? Well, it turns out that Zora is living a nice, quiet life in Jersey with her kids and her boyfriend.
Oh, that's true. Wait a minute. Her kids and her boyfriend?
Her kids and her boyfriend. And she's still a yoga teacher, and she also acts in television commercials. In fact, this from the Trentonian. If you have insomnia, you've probably seen me.
Well, if you really want to get an Evan Marriott autographed swatch card, there is one on eBay right now with a buy it now of $10.
Oh man,
that'll go nice.
That'll go nice with the Manimal Annual 1984.
Chase the Manimal Annual. It's numbered out of 250. It's number 189 out of 250. But if you don't want the swatch, well, you know what? You could just get one of his regular autograph cards numbered out of 1,200.
Oh, man. Can imagine if you got all 1,200 Evan Marriott autograph cards from Donruss Americana.
Why would anybody do that? There's got to be a reason.
I would do that. Because I'm insane.
He said it, not us.
Yeah.
But yeah, just a general recommendation. If you can find the 2007 Americana, holy crap. That stuff is so fun to open. And just like every box I got was like crap and great cards. And a lot of the people that were in that series who signed autographs or just had swatches in there aren't with us anymore. Bernie Mac was in there. Ed McMahon, Jonathan Winters, Burt Reynolds. So, yeah, people that have died in the last essentially 13 years. And I just love it. I'm obviously a celebrity fan. It's not everybody's cup of tea, especially in the sports card market. But the baseball card shop I go to, he knew after that first series. I bought him out of like all his cards. I mean, he had like three or four boxes, and I bought them all out because I loved it that much. Every time a series got released, and there's been, I think, I want to say three or four more series since then, he'd always get a couple boxes, and I'd be there the first day, and I'm like, okay, Adam, you know what I want. Give me two boxes of the Americana, and, it's just great fun to open.
It's always good to open something with regards to Americana. I've always fancied myself a student of Americana. I guess, okay, somebody stop me before I go into a trivia nerd mode again.
And this has been another episode of Mike Klaus Shill's Sports Cards.
So that was Joe Millionaire. A man falls in love with a woman. Man admits that he is not a millionaire. Man and women split $1 million, and that was pretty much all she wrote, because she sold all her jewelry. Didn't think I'd come back to that, did ya?
Oh, there's the pawn shop connection, okay.
Yeah, she sold all the jewelry, gave the money to her parents. What? You know what? I really wanted these two to work. These two are awesome people. They're awesome. She sold all the jewelry and gave the money to her parents. He is about as humble as a reality contestant can possibly be. You really can't ask for better. Or can you?
What?
Because the legend of Joe Millionaire is not over, folks. Fox ordered a second season, found a second Joe, and amazingly found 14 English-speaking European women who had never heard of Joe Millionaire.
Which really is a good thing, because once you do this, given how much promotion there was for Joe Millionaire leading up to its premiere, there's no way you could legitimately do this more than once, or at least in the United States. You had to go outside the United States to find potential contestants.
And he did, and they did find potential contestants, but let's talk about the contestants were from the Czech Republic, Germany, the Netherlands, Italy, and Sweden. During casting, again, calling from Truth by Consensus Wikipedia, the women were told by Fox that the show that we're going to appear on would involve a group of European women interacting with American men on an island somewhere. That didn't happen. Instead, it was moved to northern Italy and And the chateau was replaced by a nice little villa, something out of Vicky Cristina Barcelona, but in Italy instead of Spain. And then there needed to be a new Joe. Enter David Smith, a 24-year-old cowboy and ranch hand and probably a part-time model. I mean, he could very well be from Midland, Texas. The year before the show aired, he had earned only $11,000. But
whoa.
Well, maybe he did modeling on the side for Texas Muscle.
Maybe he did. But again, Paul Hogan, ever the gentleman, was there to help in any way, shape, or form he saw fit.
And God bless him.
God bless Paul Hogan. We all need a wingman. Am I right?
Yes.
I think there's more than the wingman, to be honest.
Paul Hogan did everything on this show.
Well, and what Paul Hogan didn't do was left up to a young, then unknown budding TV host by the name of Samantha Harris.
Oh, yes, Samantha Harris.
Yeah, she would go on to bigger and better things, but she cut her teeth here.
And she was a very big... What's-her-face?
Improvement over...
Alex McLeod?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you see how big Alex McLeod is. What's-her-face?
Yeah, more like who's-her-face. Anyway, so, like the last season... They called all of the women to a final two, but not before they are reminded almost at every single turn of how rich this guy was supposedly. And unlike Evan, David was said to have made his millions in the oil industry. A likely story.
Well, it's a good backstory because he's from Texas.
I was just about to say.
Just because anyone from Texas who's rich, you've probably seen, oh yeah, oil.
We all saw Dallas. We know what you're talking about. I'm pretty sure
Dallas was very big in Europe.
It was, I think, yes.
It was.
Yeah. That's not a joke. It was very big in Europe. The Europeans love themselves there, Larry Hagman.
Dallas, it was a thing on European television. So, this show, it actually started on October 20th. But here's the thing. That was like the highest rated show of that season. It fell off quickly. And by quickly, I mean quickly. Episode 5, they were doubling up on episodes for each night. Yet episodes 5 and 6 on November 10th, episodes 7 and 8 on November 17th, and episodes 9 and 10 on November 24th. They were just, okay, let's burn this off and get the hell out of here.
Yeah, the burn off is never a good sign.
No.
Yeah, and again, Sandy Grushow, who was the head of entertainment for Fox at the time, had said, Joe Millionaire has gone from one of TV's most surprising successes to one of TV's most spectacular flameouts. Our instincts told us from the very beginning that Joe Millionaire was a one-time stunt, and I think we got greedy. We tried to sneak it by the American public a second time, and we got called on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we all knew what the premise was. The only people who didn't know the premise were all the contestants in that version.
Yep. Well, it's like, what can we say? They found people who had never heard of Joe Millionaire. They thought they could get away with it twice and failed miserably. Here's an interesting thing about this season. One of the women, a Czech lady by the name of Linda Kostova, she took herself out. She literally took herself out. But she came back and ultimately went on to win the whole thing. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Linda was actually a Czech model, so there was that. She ended up winning the whole shooting match. And for her trouble, she was told the truth, and ultimately she ended up resenting David Smith for it. Which,
So in other words, David Smith did not get his checkmate.
Go to your room, Michael.
I'm leaving. Bye bye.
Okay, so that left. So after he thought that everything was all nice and done and put away and whatever and what have you, he decided to take his ball and go back to Texas. But waiting for him at Texas at a private ranch was Linda and...
Huh?
Yep. Yeah, Linda was waiting.
What?
And Paul was waiting as well. Hey, Mr. Paul!
What? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, the ranch he was staying at the time, just, you know, to decompress from being a big fat phony on television, Paul gave him the ranch.
Oh, my goodness!
As for Linda... She had won $250,000.
Oh man!
And again, you would think that they would last as a couple. Of course, they did not.
Oh.
Well, she took her money, and I guess she went back to Prague. But we do have this. We do have this little snippet from an interview she did soon after. They asked her, what happened between you and David after the show? And she says, this is her talking now, even afterwards, we didn't have any private dates because when we went out, the production people would be there sitting next to us, so it was very strange. We had one dinner together, and the next day I flew back to Prague. He flew back to LA, and after that I didn't see him for almost 3 months. They didn't let me go to the US, and they didn't let him come to Prague, so they kind of ruined the whole relationship. When I watched the show now, 1 year later, I think maybe we could have done more, but at that time it was very stressful. I thought we would have to stay together and all that. I think that's why it didn't work. And then they asked. So if David asked you to come live with him in LA now, would you? She says, I don't know if I would live with him, but I would like to see him again. I'm actually going to the States next week, so I emailed him to see if we could meet. I'm much more relaxed this year and I see him differently now. Unfortunately, that's about as much as we know of what happened to the fair Linda and our good friend David Smith. So, and that was Joe Millionaire.
Guys, I just know before we wrap up, we neglected to mention one small thing.
What's that?
Paul Hogan was on the Donny Osmond version of Pyramid.
And
he was on the Bergeron version of Hollywood Squares.
Yes. Like we said, if anything came from this, Paul Hogan was perhaps the hero America needed in 2003.
Yeah, especially, you know, we were going to war in Iraq. I mean, we needed something to distract our minds from the depressing news every day, and Paul Hogan gave us that joy.
He made that series. Paul Hogan made that show, and we thank him for making that show. So again,
and we haven't heard from him since.
Oh, that's just
no.
Sad.
I'm sure wherever he is in Australia or whatever, He's probably in Australia right now, probably helping the firefighters fight those fires right now.
Yeah. By the way, if we could just take a pause for that, there are several charities just looking to help all the people who have been displaced by the fires and all the animals that have been displaced. If you go to the Googles, I'm sure you're going to find some. So, you know, let it not be said that we didn't provide a public service on this show.
Yes.
So what can we say about Joe Millionaire? It was the feel-good hit of 2003. But after that, it was a thing on TV.
It was a thing on TV, but it wouldn't be the last time Fox tried this format, because in 2014, they would have future installment, I Wanna Marry Harry.
Oh,
no.
Really?
No.
Yes.
No, I'm not saying no list. For that reason. I Wanna Marry Harry. Do we have to?
Yes. Can I say? Reality is a hairy Mary.
Hey, it's very timely given Harry's been in the news recently.
Well, that's true, but I think I'm going to have to call sick that week. Well, that was Joe Millionaire. So, as always, remember you can find everything about this podcast, our social media, email address. It's all at itwasathingontv.com. And the email is contact@itwasathingontv.com. If you have any sort of requests or questions or complaints or anything like that, or if you want to buy my Evan Marriott 2007 Americana swatch card, mint condition. I'm only asking $50 for it.
Well, guys, we had a lot of fun with this episode. Our next episode later this week, this is going to be the episode I think we've been talking about this for months, and we're finally going to cover it.
And this one, it's going to be a little esoteric, to say the least. It's not something you'd expect to hear on this podcast necessarily, but it's something that we came up with really early in the process. So hopefully you'll get some enjoyment out of it.
Yes. So until next time, I'm Greg, that's Chico, and that was Mike. And we'll see you on our next episode. See you guys later.
Before we start taping the next episode, guys, I'm going to go to California Muscle. I need some new underwear.
Oh, for the love of God!
Oh, God, why am I? Why? Why?
No. Ooh, crotchless!
Now that... Oh, no. Now that image is in my head. Thanks.
Don't want to imagine Evan Marriott in crotches.
Stop! Stop, please! For the love of God, stop!